I should probably say up front that Vivian Leigh feels optimistic about fixing the country's broken healthcare system. Her new book has solutions. It has innovators and programs that could work, are working. But before we can get to the good stuff, we have to talk about the problems, which you could sum up this way. When it comes to healthcare in this country, we pay more for less.
One of the biggest paradoxes about healthcare is the fact that we spend so much money on healthcare for Americans. We spend two and a half, even three times as much per person on healthcare compared to any of the other high-income nations in the world. The average baby born in America today will live 4, 5, or 6 years less than the average baby born in Italy, in Israel, Australia, Japan. Even though we're spending two and a half, three times as much. And at the same time, we've hit almost a 50% burnout rate among physicians, and that's before COVID. It's even worse now. So we're really working in a healthcare system that is remarkably dysfunctional. You know, it's unlike any other problem, like education or the criminal justice system or poverty just generally, you know, where we don't have enough money. Here we actually have enough money. In fact, if anything, we're spending too much money. The system is just broken.
Vivian Leigh is a healthcare executive. She spent time here in Utah as the CEO of the University of Utah's health system. But she's also a physician, a radiologist, and a researcher. And she told us that early in her practice, she was excited about the pace of new technology, discoveries about genomics and stem cell therapy and the microbiome. The future, she said, looked amazing. But then when she would look at the system where all of these innovations were supposed to be implemented, she saw a mess, a process that was wasteful and expensive. It was creating deadly mistakes. It was choked with bureaucracy. And it was at this point she went to Boston on a journey, she says, that changed the trajectory of her career.
I was interested in learning more about how to build a better research administrative structure. So I reached out to a friend of mine at the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston named Greg Meyer, and he introduced me to their research team. And so I decided to make a field trip up there. And while I was there, Greg pulled me aside to show me what he'd been working on. And they had built their own electronic medical record system way before most hospitals had them. And when he pulled me aside, he started telling me about what they did with that electronic medical record system. They had known for a while that the way in which they were getting paid to deliver care to the patients didn't really make that much sense. It was the way everybody was doing it, but they were getting paid every time they saw a patient, every time they performed a procedure or did an operation. But it didn't really matter if the patient turned out for the better or for the worse. They still got paid. And they thought, well, we can probably do better because now we have all these data from the electronic medical records and we can see whether we are making a positive impact on our patients. And so they proposed a new way of getting paid for delivering healthcare. They said, we're going to put our money where our mouths are. We're going to say, you can pay us a base amount, but only pay us more if we actually make people healthier. And not surprisingly, they actually were very successful. They were able to show that they were making these patients healthier. And as a result, they did well financially. And so they did good and did well. And I kind of had an epiphany when I was talking with him because all of a sudden I said, well, why aren't more medical systems doing this? If we don't think that the current business model of healthcare makes sense, then why aren't we proposing better ways to do it?
You describe it as reinventing healthcare. I mean, you must have been really excited. I'm imagining you flying home thinking about let's get going because there's a model out there and this we could do it right.
Absolutely. And the lessons that I learned from the Massachusetts General Hospital on that field trip, they're multiplied all over the country. There are so many success stories, so many lessons, so many really innovative teams who are showing that healthcare doesn't have to be the way it is. And what I actually found myself doing over the next several years was collecting these stories. And then when you weave them together, you can actually start to see a pretty coherent narrative for how we could really reinvent our healthcare system. And what could be more exciting than reinventing a system that actually brings better health, better happiness, healthier longevity to all of the people in this country? I mean, there couldn't be anything more exciting than that.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with Vivian Lee. She's a radiologist, the president of Verily Health Platforms, and a senior lecturer at the Harvard Medical School. Her book is called The Long Fix: Solving America's Healthcare Crisis with Strategies That Work for Everyone. Lee told us she was motivated to write the book because she wanted to make this system, with all its moving parts and complicated economic incentives, she wanted to make it understandable to the rest of us.
In almost any other major issue that's facing us, most of us can articulate a position on it. You know, whether it's global warming or social justice or education policy, whatever it is, we know enough about it that we can form an educated opinion about it and articulate that. Whereas what I would say arguably is one of the most important things to us, our health and our healthcare system, we can't even understand it. And actually, even those of us within healthcare, many of us don't understand it. I actually wrote this book because I feel like no one ever sat me down before I became the CEO of a hospital system, for example, and told me the facts of life, like explained to me how it actually works. I learned it sort of bit by bit along the way, and it did seem really complicated. But since I have been in this a long time, and when I was the dean of the medical school, I had the privilege of teaching a lot of our first and second year students and trying to really explain it to them and telling it in narratives and stories and not a textbook. That was really a big goal of mine, was to make it easy to understand, make it kind of fun to read even, and to not to get so much in the policy weeds. You know, that's really, I don't think, very necessary, but just enough to understand that we, all of us individually, healthcare, our healthcare system, we're all paying for it, even if we think that we're covered by our employers and our, if we're fortunate enough to be so, it's still coming out of our paychecks, you know. And we should really understand how we individually can contribute to its future success, as well as in other roles, whether we're in healthcare or employers or payers or policymakers. We all have a role to play, but we have to understand it. And that's really one of my biggest motivations in writing this book.
I detected something of a theme in the book in that it seems like one of the things you keep coming back to is that physicians and other healthcare professionals have lost sight of the thing that got them into the thing that took them there in the first place, that passion for wanting to care for people. Because of bureaucracy, because of these weird incentives, all of those kinds of things. And I'm wondering if that makes this kind of personal for you, that one of the things that you noticed was that the thing that may have drawn you into the experience people were losing sight of that. Am I right about that?
You're completely right about that. I mean, one of the reasons why we have these national physician burnout rates of 40, 45, 50% is because people have gotten, it's like they're on the hamster wheel. And this is, you know, fundamentally, I think the problem in the business model of how we do healthcare is fee for service. So the more you do to patients, the more money you're paid. And as a result, our systems are set up to incentivize, encourage, or almost force physicians and other healthcare providers just do. And that really takes the joy out of our work. I mean, we want to talk to patients. We want to connect with them. We want to spend time with them. We don't want to spend our whole time typing at the computer and at night, you know, clicking on our electronic health records just so we can keep billing. That's not really why we got into the practice. You know, I will say that I am very optimistic about the future, though, because I think that the young people who are coming into healthcare, I think they know coming in that healthcare is going to change pretty dramatically. My generation came in not expecting much change. And so it's been hard for us. It's been hard for us to adapt. But the new generations that are coming in are ready for change. They embrace technology. They understand that digital health, for example, might leapfrog a lot of the problems that we're facing. And so, you know, I think what they need is a little bit more of an understanding of how healthcare actually works. And that's what the long fix is supposed to be, is to sort of educate them on that. But I think that they have enough of an understanding of the tools that are available to them and an appetite for that change. And so I hope that they can help us drive to a brighter future.
Say a little bit more about what you identify as the root of this crisis we're experiencing. It's a system where you, as you say, you pay for action. It's a fee for service system, a system that rewards action, not necessarily outcomes. Talk about just that basic concept.
Well, it's pretty remarkable when you think about it, because right now we are paid in healthcare for doing things to people. And it really doesn't matter, for the most part, whether we're really successful in making people healthy or not. So I'll give you a little example of a discussion around a neurosurgeon that I spoke with who takes out brain tumors. And he's a superb surgeon, just absolutely superb. And yet, he was actually, in the way in which we get paid, every time he takes out a brain tumor, you know, we get paid.
Yeah.
And the government started to introduce a little bit of, you know, well, maybe we want to start thinking about whether you're doing it well or not. Okay, so this is like toe in the water of moving to paying for better health, actually, instead of just doing it. But it's the step is such a baby step that they said, well, you know, basically, we think we're going to judge you as being a really good surgeon if you can ensure that your patients don't develop any complications in the hospital. Like they don't get a urinary tract infection. That's really important. And so he was getting criticized as not being a very high quality surgeon because some of his patients, the catheters that were in their bladders were staying in a little bit too long. And so he said to me, you know, Vivian, why doesn't anyone ask me, did I get the brain tumor out? Did I get the whole thing out? Can the patient still talk? Can they still walk? And you know what? It doesn't make any bit of difference. We'd still get paid. If he left half of it in, we'd still get paid, which is really remarkable. It's really remarkable. So it's no surprise that when you have a healthcare system that is just rewarded for doing more things to people, even if we individually as doctors are trying to do the right thing, the system, you know, all the powerful forces of capitalism are driving us to do more, to waste more, and not necessarily driving us where we want, which is to produce better health and to do that more efficiently, actually at lower costs. So that's what we really need to change. We need to change the business model of healthcare.
You say in the book that we in this country don't really buy healthcare. We buy insurance. What's the difference?
Well, buying insurance, you know, it really, one of the things about most of the businesses in America are, you know, we're a capitalist society. And we rely on capitalism to drive competition and drive innovation and drive more value to the consumer, make better products, lower cost, you know. But in healthcare, one of the reasons why we haven't succeeded, or in fact, if anything, we've almost gone the opposite direction. We've increased cost and actually lowered health is one of the reasons is because of the way in which we separate out the consumer or the individual or the patient really through this insurance model. And so it means that, you know, I'll give you one example. So I often talk to people about the fact that just because you have health insurance doesn't mean that you're not paying for it. In fact, I tell the story, there was an employee, actually a manager in one of our companies at the University of Utah, one of our subsidiaries, who was being recommended, I think, a lower cost medication. And he said, no, I want a higher cost one because I don't want to directly quote him, but, you know, I want to get that insurance company. And then we had to remind him, we actually say, actually, you know, those are your dollars that are paying. It's just coming out. It's not coming out directly. So we individually, we each pay for healthcare at least three different ways. We pay for it directly out of pocket with our out of pocket costs, like our copays. We pay for it in our taxes. And then it comes out of our paychecks. We don't see it. The last 50 to 60 years, we've seen, while the economy has grown in the U.S., our wages have basically been flat. And the difference has really all gone to cover our health insurance. And as a result, when people don't think they're paying for it, they say, well, you know, maybe I don't really need that antibiotic for my cough or cold, but I might as well get it because insurance is already covering it. Or I'm not feeling that, I'll just go into the emergency room, even though probably could wait until tomorrow I could go and see my primary care doc. Or my back hurts a little bit, well, I'll just get the MRI, even though I probably don't need it. So all of those things happen as a result of our system and people just not really understanding that it is our money. We're paying for it. And if the more MRIs you do this year, next year, that's why your premiums have gone up.
You say in this arrangement, the goal for the insurance company is to spend as little as possible on a patient's health. For doctors and hospitals, the incentive is to spend as much as possible. You describe it as a tug of war.
I call it the trillion-dollar tug of war every year. And unfortunately, so what happens is, you know, at the beginning of the year, everyone pays in their premiums. So the insurance company or the administrators have this big pool of money. And of course, the less they spend out, the more they keep, the more they make. And in a fee-for-service model, hospitals and doctors want to just keep billing so that they can generate some revenue and income for themselves. And what happens in this tug of war, though, is it's actually very costly because when you think about two behemoth industries at it, you know, in conflict every year, they put up a lot of resources just to kind of battle this out that don't actually help anyone. So the insurance companies will put up these barriers like, you know, we need prior authorization, meaning for you to get your MRI, the doctors have to fill out this whole stack of paperwork just to justify it. You know, they try to put up barriers. Meanwhile, the hospitals have these massive teams of billing and coding people to try to modify the bills so that they can, say, claim more money and increase the reimbursement. And all of that just adds to our administrative costs. In this country, we have two and a half, almost three times the administrative cost of most other high-income European-type nations, for example. And so it's just waste. And then when we can't resolve it, what happens? When we can't resolve it, the bill falls to the patient. And that's when we hear about this balance billing or surprise billing. And these poor, unfortunate patients get saddled with these big bills because the two weren't able to work it out. So we really, you know, one of the ways in which I'm very optimistic about the future is that we're seeing completely new models that get us out of this tug of war. And one of them that I talk about in the book a lot is Medicare Advantage, part of the Medicare program for seniors. It now has about a third of all seniors in it, Medicare Advantage. And it just changes the business model completely, turns it upside down, and creates a model where the two are no longer at odds. They're no longer at this massive tug of war. They actually, insurers and the doctors are working together to try to keep patients healthier.
Vivian Lee, her book is The Long Fix, Solving America's Healthcare Crisis with Strategies That Work for Everyone. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
When you support the news that you trust on KUER, you can easily manage your financial contribution with MyKUER. It's our online portal where you can provide your contact information, change the amount of your donation, or update your billing information, like when your credit card expires or maybe you've switched financial institutions. You can sign up for an online donor profile at KUER.org/MyKUER.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Vivian Lee is with us this hour. You'll probably remember her. She used to be the CEO of the University of Utah's health system. She's also a radiologist, and she's written a book outlining how the model we've come to follow in the American healthcare system, this fee-for-service model, is backward. It's not efficient, it's not compassionate, it's ridiculously expensive, and it's just not producing results. Lee says we should be paying for outcomes, not services. It's a switch in the model, she says, could make all the difference. Her book is called The Long Fix. I want to talk more about the models and the way forward, but you do also reference how we got here, the kind of history of this. And you talk about sort of trace it to the beginning of Medicare, basically, 1965. And we developed this supply-driven demand economy. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about what it is that happened there. Was it the weakness in the American economy? Was it a way of thinking? Was it some sort of characteristic that allowed this to become a problem, where we're motivated to not necessarily make people healthier? I mean, what is the American characteristic that got us to that point that we didn't see coming, that we didn't stop in those decades as it was developing and evolving?
Well, we decided early on to do a couple of things differently from the rest of the world. We decided unintentionally, really, at the end of World War II to bring employers into the healthcare business, to provide a tax benefit and to allow employers to offer healthcare. It was really a strategy for employers at the time during the war and after the war to outcompete others in terms of labor because of the labor shortages. But that was one thing that we did, which definitely set us off on a different trajectory from the rest of the high-income nations, because now all of a sudden you have employers, the private sector, thinking about how to support healthcare for their employees. And now that's about half of all Americans in the country have that model. The employers as a whole, though, weren't really able to drive policies or define the business. It was really the government that did that through the Medicare program, as you alluded to. And even to this day, employers tend to follow whatever Medicare does, even though employers are covering half of all Americans. And as you say, in the 1960s, when Medicare first started, I think nobody had any sense that it would grow to the way it did, which was, they were a benefits program. And when the members saw a doctor, they would just pay the doctor. The doctor would bill them, and then they would pay the doctor's bill. And it started, I think, harmlessly enough. But over time, as you see that, every time I see a patient, I get paid. Every time I do a lab test on them, I get paid. Then we created a system to tier the amount of payment based on the complexity of the interaction, which favored more procedures. It favored more, whether it's operations or colonoscopies or those kind of procedures over just talking to people. This was called the relative value units. So they wanted, it made sense. I think at the time, Medicare said, of course, if it's a more complicated thing, if it requires more technology, we should pay more. Talking doesn't seem to be that expensive, so we'll pay less for that. And as a result, then what they were doing was incentivizing a hospital who was trying to stay afloat or make money to do more and more procedures and to invest more and more in technology and to value less and less primary care, prevention, mental health, where we're mostly talking to people. And so it did lead to what you mentioned and I call supply-driven demand, because we got to the point where we discovered that, let's say my own field in MRI, I'm an MRI radiologist, an MRI imaging center or a surgery center or a cancer center could generate enormous amounts of revenue for a health system. Because once we open an MRI scanner, sure enough, before you know it, we would be recommending more and more MRIs to all of our patients. And so it became supply-driven demand. And now it's got to the point where we are spending three times as much per person on everybody and on everybody who has insurance, and certainly not everybody who doesn't have insurance, and have just really poor outcomes to show for it. So it's been a slippery, you know, it's, I don't think anybody intended it back in the 60s, but it's not surprising if you set up the right incentives, that's what people will do. And I'll just say on the other side, I do put some responsibility onto each of us as individuals.
Yeah.
I mean, a big reason why I put the action plans at the end of every chapter to say, okay, here's what you should think about if as a person, as a patient, as a family member. We're individually responsible too. You know, every time we ask for that extra antibiotic for our kid who just has a cold, we're driving up healthcare costs. Every time there's a kind of a notion that more is better, and more isn't really better in healthcare. There are a lot of consequences to that drive. And so we also individually have some responsibility there too.
I want to get to some of these imperatives that you write about. You've identified a number of them, I think five. Pay for results instead of action. That's a big one for you. And one of the sections in the book, you write about how the best investments are going to be designed to keep people at home, to keep them independent, to use family, to use community as part of that care. Like, this is just going to be good business. And it gets us to this great story of the Chen family in Florida, in Miami. Chris Chen, you write about, and his father's clinic in Miami. His father's a doctor. His mother was the office manager. And they experimented with this model. Take us through that story, if you would.
Sure. So this is the start of chapter two, and I'm talking to Chris Chen, and he's telling me about how his memories of what people used to say about his father. So it starts, go see that crazy Chinese doctor who takes care of all the poor Cubans. Chris Chen grins as he tells me how people used to rave about his father's clinic in Miami. His father had started as a typical primary care doctor in private practice. He was paid fee for service, which meant the more patients he saw, the more he earned. Then in South Florida in the early 1990s, a few insurance companies started experimenting with new ways to pay doctors. Instead of fee for service, they gave them a fixed amount per patient each year. If a patient needed expensive imaging, costly drugs, or long hospitalizations that added up to more than that amount, it was the doctor's problem. Chris's dad, the doctor, and mom, the office manager, experimented in this new model. They welcomed referrals, but other doctors sent them only their frailest and poorest patients, the ones they knew would be grossly unprofitable under this new way of paying. That's how Chris's parents began with 250 of the sickest people in Miami, people who would have been almost impossible to keep well at any facility at any price. It looked as if the Chens had signed up for a financial suicide mission. I go on to talk about what they actually did. They completely reinvented the way of caring for patients. They decided that they needed to set up visits for their patients, even if they weren't sick. Mm. They provided free door-to-door transportation because they knew that just averting one hospitalization or one ambulance ride would more than cover that shuttle service. They had an on-site pharmacy. And somehow at the end of the day, they were able to break even, and they made their patients healthier. They actually lowered the number of hospitalizations, and actually through investing in primary care and prevention, they actually kept these patients healthier.
It's interesting. So it seems risky as a business concept. I mean, it pays off, but they have these shuttle service you mentioned. They offer yoga classes. They have these social hours. And you'd think that this would just cost more. I mean, this is the other thing about the Chen experiment, which I found fascinating, where normally a physician will spend, you know, 20, 15, 20, 10 minutes sometimes. They were spending up to an hour with their patients, certain patients anyway. And so it seems like it costs more up front. But you say in the book that if you look at the larger picture, that it really ends up saving them money just because, I guess, there were fewer hospital visits? Is that what made this a good business model?
Exactly what happened. One hospitalization can be tens of thousands of dollars. Huh. And so in this payment model where the Chens, all of the doctors in that medical group or at Iora Health or at Presby, all of these different health systems, they get paid a fixed amount. And if those patients end up in the hospital, they're paying the hospital bill. They actually pay the hospital bill. So even though they had to spend more money in primary care, of course, if you spend 60 minutes per patient, you're not going to see as many patients as a clinic that sees 10 minutes. Mm. But in the long run, it more than paid off. They've actually done very well financially, these Medicare Advantage groups, because they've reduced those hospitalizations, very costly hospitalizations. That's what it means from a business perspective. But think about it, what it means from a human being perspective.
Right. Yeah.
You're talking about frail elderly people. Rarely do they come out of a hospitalization perkier and better off than before they, you know, than the before they had to go in. It's so difficult for patients to go into the hospital. Even though we try to take care of them, we try to make them better, it's often part of a decline. So what they've done is really help these seniors stay healthier and live better lives.
One of the things you write about is how the healthcare industry can really learn the lessons from basically from industrial engineering, you know, operations like the automobile industry. Say a little bit about W. Edward Deming and the Toyota way, because this was a really fascinating part of the story.
So Edward Deming was brought, he was one of these, I guess, early industrial engineering experts. Yeah. And he looked at, used a lot of statistics to look at variation, try to really get manufacturing to practice in a much more consistent way to deliver reliable products. And this was at the end of World War II. He had already done some of this work successfully in the U.S., but the Japanese, whose economy was really in shambles, decided to bring Deming over to Japan to help them improve their manufacturing. Actually, one of the funny stories that I came across when I was writing the book was there was actually a town named USA, USA, right, in Japan. Yeah. And some of these Japanese companies would put a manufacturing plant in USA just so that they could say made in USA,
right,
on their products. So anyway, they were not the Sonys and Panasonics of today that we know. So Deming went over there and he spent a lot of time with the folks at Toyota in particular. And it's what's led to many books that you read about the Toyota way, mm-hmm, and really helped them improve and standardize their manufacturing. Then he came back to the U.S. Having had that success in Japan and worked with, you know, GE and all these big automotive manufacturers in the U.S. and other companies. And what we realized was that in healthcare, we are falling far short of the kind of standards in the rest of the economy. You know, Six Sigma, we're not even close. And one of the really interesting experiences that I had early on in the journey was learning more about Deming and this way of improving safety and improving quality. And it was from visiting an airbag manufacturing company that's just up the road from the University of Utah's health system, and touring their facility and seeing how they were manufacturing airbags. They had a direct connection because they were one of the first companies that Toyota had outsourced to the manufacturing of their airbags. And so early on, the Japanese folks, the folks from Toyota, sent them some of these experts and taught them how to do this. And so we went up the road. And it was so striking to me because their slogans and their mantras, you know, they're doing airbags. It was all about safety and lives, and we're saving lives and we're helping people. I'm thinking, oh, that sounds a lot like what we do, you know, in hospitals, except that their goals were zero error rates,
yeah,
you know, or less than one in a million error rates. And meanwhile, if you look at a hospital, error rates are around 30%. Mm. So around 30%. And whether they're medication mistakes or surgical mistakes or communication mistakes or imaging mistakes, whatever it is. And the thought that we could learn from an airbag manufacturing company just really blew my mind. But we did. And many hospitals and healthcare systems from around the country are doing that, are really taking in those practices, standardizing these practices, like the operating rooms. That's sort of one of the most obvious starting points, so that everybody knows the ritual. We know what we're supposed to do. We operate in tandem. We know which materials we're going to use. Everything has just got a set way of doing it. And that's, you know, where it has been adopted is it's significantly improved safety and quality. But you'll be surprised, Doug, that it's not universal. We're nowhere close to Six Sigma in healthcare. In fact, our safety records, I think, have not improved nationally very much at all. So there's still a lot of work to be done.
What's the resistance, do you think? Is it I'm wondering, is this another one of those sort of maddening cultural things where healthcare doesn't want to adapt some of these models for some reason? They think they're different? Or, I mean, like, what is the obstacle if you've even been able to identify what it might be?
That's a great question. There was a report that was written 20 years ago now from the Institute of Medicine, which is now the National Academy of Medicine, about crossing the quality chasm. It was about medical mistakes. And on the 20th anniversary, I think the community still feels like we really haven't made that much progress. There's been some improvement. I'd say that there are a couple of reasons. One is that I think as a nation, we really haven't prioritized medical safety. One of my colleagues, Karen Feinstein, who is at the Jewish Health Foundation, which is a nonprofit in Pittsburgh, during the COVID pandemic now has really advocated for us to create something very similar to the National Transportation Safety Board, you know, that is really responsible for, you know, it's the reason why airline crashes are just so, so rare, right? The work that's been done in aviation has been really remarkable. And couldn't we learn a lot from that? And so she's been working with a number of people. I've participated a little bit in this on advocating for a national patient safety authority where we can actually collect information, collect data from around the country, be able to measure medical mistakes, measure quality and safety. One of the challenges, you know, in writing this book, when I was writing about safety, some of the statistics right now are showing that medical mistakes, depending on if you believe the data, are the third leading cause of death in the country.
Can I just say this was the most troubling part of the book for me, this part where you write about the medical mistakes that are being made. I hadn't realized it's jaw-dropping in some ways.
Well, you know, we don't know the number. What's really distressing about, so it's definitely been disputed. You know, some people think it's not that high. The Institute of Medicine had this report, To Err Is Human, that projected maybe it was half the number that people are saying now. So maybe it was only 100,000 people a year dying as opposed to 200,000 to 400,000 people dying because it's not reported.
Yeah.
You know, nobody has on their death certificate died from a medical mistake.
Right.
So it's very difficult to measure. And if you can't measure it, it's hard to hold people accountable and it's hard to improve. So part of this idea of some kind of a national patient safety authority or some kind of a system where we can at least measure outcomes and at a broader scale, not relying on each individual hospital or each individual medical group to report it, but simply collect the data nationally and do the right analyses. I think that's probably a very important first step. I also think that there needs to be a lot more attention to requiring hospitals and healthcare systems to implement these practices that are, as I said, universal in manufacturing.
Yeah.
The same standards, we need to be held to similar standards. Now, part of holding people to standards is also giving them the tools. So I think it's unfair, you know, healthcare systems, especially now during COVID, many of them are teetering on the brink of insolvency. This is not the moment to just come in right. In a very top heavy way and say, do this, or, you know, that's going to hurt our economy even more and hurt our health even more if we have to shut down a bunch of hospitals. That's not what we want to do, but we do need to, those tools are readily available. It's like I said, it's just widely known. But we need to create and make those tools available to hospitals and health systems and provide a ramp up to their deployment, effective deployment, and then really set these expectations. And we need to start now.
Yeah.
I mean, we should have started 20 years ago, to be honest with you. But I think that's a high, high priority.
Right. Well, you also mentioned how it's not as if we have a raft of incompetent surgeons and doctors making these medical mistakes. I mean, a significant part of the reason for some of these mistakes seem to be just basic distraction because of the bureaucracy and the sort of complicated nature of getting their work done these days.
you know, part of being on this hamster wheel of healthcare and kind of being in an environment where we really have very little, many of the designs of the systems that we work in. I tell this really tragic story in the beginning, which really, you know, was a child that died because the medical resident connected the wrong tubing. Because he couldn't tell the difference, you know.
They all look the same.
The connectors all look the same. They look the same. How could you have an oxygen tubing line look the same as an IV tubing line? I mean, that just makes no sense at all. How can you have, like right now, even we talk about medication mistakes, you know, why do we allow pharmaceutical companies to name their drugs in ways that are really confusing? I mean, I talk about Cerebix, Celebrex, and Celexa. I can't even say the names. They're so similar.
Yeah.
You know, why would we let that happen and then say, oh, I can't believe you made a mistake with that, you know? So there's some really simple things that we can do, but we can also focus a lot more on the design of our hospitals and clinics, and how do we actually create an environment that is not full of distractions. I can't remember the exact number, but the number of times that a nurse is distracted on their way to delivering a medication, you know, it's impossible. It's an impossible environment for people to work in. And it's frustrating because everybody wants to do the right thing. You know, the last thing that we want to do in healthcare is to harm somebody. And so it's just doubly painful when something bad does happen. But there are ways to make it better. I mean, we can make great cars. Why can't we make these processes foolproof? We can. We just need to, you know, it needs to be a priority, and it especially needs to be a priority by those who are paying and those who are regulating.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about a conversation you had with former Governor Mike Leavitt. You mentioned in the book how he had been reading this book, and a lot of listeners may have read it, by Walter Isaacson, called The Innovators. And Leavitt was seeing these lessons in that story about, you know, the computer industry and how they were innovators in those early days. And he was thinking about the arc, that story, as the arc of the history in healthcare. Talk a little bit about what Mike Leavitt is thinking about.
Well, first of all, you know, Mike Leavitt is somebody who has been thinking about healthcare in such a thoughtful way for such a long time that I really wanted to talk with him and get his insights when I was writing this book. So he, having read this book, Isaacson's book, really took a step back and said, you know, we're really facing a real challenge right now in how we think about healthcare. There's this tension between the desire to be compassionate and the desire to be financially successful. And the reality there, you know, is that the average hospital in this country is living on very thin margins, you know, 2-3%. That's very thin margins for very high cost systems, you know, very expensive systems to run. And that tension right now, I think, is what makes solving healthcare not only so difficult, but also such an imperative. Because as we're seeing, especially with the COVID pandemic, not only are we seeing just the effects of not investing enough in public health and prevention, you know, the fact that the people who are most susceptible to the really severe forms of COVID are the people who have preventable conditions like diabetes and hypertension and obesity. Not only are we seeing the challenges on our own health, but we are going to feel those financial impacts in the years to come. You know, our rising deficit, it means that we won't have enough money to continue to spend as we are on healthcare. And so the last thing that we want to do now is to cut access to healthcare. We don't want to do that. I mean, we want to be compassionate. People who are suffering now, the last thing we want to say is, no, sorry, there's no more money for you to go see the doctor. You may have COVID, but just go suffer at home. You know, we need to be compassionate. And it's that tension that we're trying to solve. And what Mike said, what Governor Leavitt said was, this is This is a process that's going to take a little bit of time. We're probably, he guesstimated, maybe in the middle of one of these 40-year cycles. I think with COVID, it's going to be accelerated. I actually don't think we have the time to take another 15 or 20 years to figure this out. I think it's going to be more like the next 5 years that we really need to move forward. But that I hope that what moves us, what accelerates, you know, there are a lot of challenging issues in our political landscape. But the one thing that I've discovered from talking to people on both sides of the aisle for this book is that there is a shared sense of commitment to fixing healthcare and a shared vision of the path there. This idea of moving to paying for better value, paying for better health outcomes. Doug, that's actually, the words may not be exactly the same, but they're almost exactly the same if you listen to folks on both sides of the aisle. So I'm optimistic that we can move forward, but obviously it is a complex problem, so we need a lot of things to sync together.
Well, that's one of your guiding principles that you write about in the book, is that healthcare needs to be seen as a problem with bipartisan solutions. And you talk about how there needs to be this collective will to move this forward. So it sounds like you're pretty optimistic that we can get over that really partisan divide right now. Because if you look at the news for just this week about the, you know, case before the Supreme Court, this provision in the Affordable Care Act, you see how the question about healthcare can be really deeply partisan. But you sound hopeful that we can get past that.
There's a lot of support within the healthcare community for many of the things that the Affordable Care Act has achieved. The Affordable Care Act was in large part based on what Governor Romney did in the state of Massachusetts. And it has this movement towards increasing the number of people who have access to insurance or changing the payment model so that we are paying for better health outcomes. That work has continued under the current administration. So I don't want to be painted as somebody who is too much of a Pollyanna, but I do feel that from my vantage point in talking to people who have been in healthcare a long time, regardless of their party affiliation, there's a pretty clear shared understanding of how we need to get there. And so part of the reason why I wanted to write The Long Fix and to share with everyone was to give you a sense of where there are disagreements. For example, there are disagreements about whether there should be work requirements, for example, for Medicaid, or disagreements basically about, you know, whether people should pay for health care. Increasingly, the majority of Americans actually do believe that everyone should have access to health care, that there should be universal health care. The debate is about how, you know, whether individuals should make their own financial contribution.
Right. Whether it should
be free.
I think
those are issues that can get resolved.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah. The question of whether it should be free. That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And in many countries, there is a means-based testing strategy. So even many countries in Europe, you know, there is the expectation that individuals will pay if they can afford it, will pay a small copayment, for example. We've, in the U.S., sometimes used those have been interpreted more as barriers to getting access to care. And so I think we have to work out strategies. There's also, I think, a stronger appetite now for looking outside of our borders and learning from other countries. And I really welcome that too, because of course we're unique, but we're not that unique. So we can definitely learn from other countries. And I think that can also lead us to some solutions that can be acceptable to everyone.
So profoundly optimistic. That was the term you used at the beginning of the book. You're not Pollyanna-ish. You made that clear. You realize the obstacles here, but you think we can figure this out.
I think so, and I think I hope that readers will share that optimism, because I think one of the ways to getting there is we all have to share that sense of optimism and have a common vision for how to get there. And I think if we share that, the one thing for sure right now is that we do have a crisis. We have a pressing crisis. And so if anything, it makes me more optimistic, because there is a huge appetite for change now. And that's what we need.
Vivian Lee, thank you very much for the time.
Thank you so much, Doug. Great to be with you.
Vivian Lee, She's the president of Verily Health Platforms and a senior lecturer at the Harvard Medical School. Her book is The Long Fix, Solving America's Healthcare Crisis with Strategies That Work for Everyone. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Ivana Martinez, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.